It's 1240. You're listening to the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Craig Cohen. Public housing was established by the federal government to provide decent and safe rental housing for eligible low-income families, the elderly, and persons with disabilities. Today, there are more than 1.2 million public housing households nationwide, yet over the past decade, communities nationwide have demolished hundreds of thousands of public housing units. Back in February, the Department of Housing and Urban Development issued a notice to curb the demolitions and preserve affordable housing stock for the lowest income Americans. Danville is one city grappling with its own public housing stock as city officials and housing authority administrators debate the future of Fair Oaks. It's the area's largest family-occupied public housing complex. With the first report in a three-part series, here's Landon Kassman.
Fair Oaks is the largest public housing complex in the city of Danville and represents the densest part of the city. Built in 1942, the complex contains 326 family units packed in uniform red brick townhouses on little more than half a square mile of land. The Fair Oaks complex is surrounded by factories and warehouses, some vacant. There's only one convenience store within walking distance, and it's at least a mile to any school or grocery stores. Fair Oaks resident Corey Dorsey doesn't think this is fair.
It's inhumane, if you ask me. You know what I'm saying? We separated from all the stores. We're not around anybody. We have really nobody but us.
Dorsey was homeless in Chicago when he decided to come to Fair Oaks. He had heard from a friend that it would be easier to survive there. Fair Oaks is disproportionately populated by unmarried black females raising children on extremely low incomes. Dorsey's girlfriend, Kiki Jones, is one of those women. She is 24 and raising her 5-year-old son, Pierre, in a Fair Oaks housing unit. She came to Danville in 2008 from a women's shelter in Crystal Lake, Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. She says Fair Oaks is not a place she wants to raise her child.
It's kind of crazy because I don't let my son outside like that because the kids are corrupted, too. It starts at home. I really am leery with Fair Oaks, very leery with it.
Though she has worked at a Wendy's restaurant and at a local factory in the past, she currently makes money doing other people's hair. She says right now, money is not a problem for her, partly because of the price of rent at Fair Oaks. Since moving in together last year, Dorsey and Jones have been paying $17 a month to live in a 2-bedroom apartment. Properties like Fair Oaks are just like other big public housing projects in that they represent what bad public housing looks like, says Danville Community Development Manager John Dreer.
Almost every city in America realized over the last 20 years that model doesn't work very well. It becomes a dead-end trap for the residents. And they started replacing it with more scattered site, more uplifting. Our housing authority didn't do that. And so we're kind of like the last kid on the block to modernize. And we are, in fact, working with the Housing Authority and within our consolidated plan right now for efforts to start looking at ways that we can replace that with something that works better.
Danville Housing Authority Director Greg Hillary agrees that the current setup of Fair Oaks is not ideal and realizes that the city is behind the curve on developing better housing. But he says that change can't happen all at once, which is what he believes the city is proposing to do.
I don't disagree that redevelopment should happen. I think we're just disagreeing on how. And I truly believe that additional housing needs to be in place before we can start knocking down buildings. We're going to have to prove to HUD that we can house folks before they're going to give us permission to tear anything down.
While city and housing authority officials continue to debate the next steps, a few public housing residents have filed a civil rights complaint against the city's previous proposal for reducing public housing. That story is next in our series. I'm Landon Kassman for Illinois Public Media.
And our series will continue tomorrow. For more information, including an interactive map, visit will.illinois.edu and cucitizenaccess.org. The fight over same-sex marriage in Illinois will soon begin to play out in the Cook County courts. Gay rights groups are launching 2 separate cases arguing the state's same-sex marriage ban is unconstitutional. But only after years of strategizing, organizing, and politicking do advocates believe their moment is now. Illinois Public Radio's Alex Keefe reports.
If you had any doubt how seriously gay rights advocates are taking these lawsuits, consider that they announced them with not one, but 2 press conferences.
Thank you. Good morning.
There's this one at a Chicago hotel scheduled for 10:30 last Wednesday morning.
Thank you, and it's great to be in Springfield.
And this one set for the exact same time about 200 miles away. And the message at both of them was, well, consistent.
And I'm here today with a simple message.
I have one simple message. It's time.
It is time.
It's time for Illinois to recognize the love and commitment of these couples.
Ed Yonka with the American Civil Liberties Union of Illinois was one of the guys behind these tandem press conferences. He's been helping coordinate media strategy during the lawsuits.
Our clients have now been, you know, through newspaper stories and radio and television, literally all over the state.
Those stories come from the 25 same-sex couples represented by the ACLU and Lambda Legal, an LGBT rights group. But leaders in Illinois' gay rights movement know that news stories alone won't win same-sex marriage. They've also spent years hosting town hall meetings, talking to church groups, and haggling with lawmakers.
People have been waiting for a long time. They're tired of waiting. We're tired of waiting.
John Knight is the ACLU's lead lawyer in its case. He says part of what they've been waiting for is public opinion. When both President Barack Obama and Governor Pat Quinn announced their support for gay marriage last month, many advocates say that was their cue.
We are looking at bringing marriage to every state in the country.
Camilla Taylor is the head lawyer in Lambda Legal's case, and she says her group has had its lawsuit drafted at the ready for 8 years. But they waited, first for Lambda's gay marriage victory before Iowa's Supreme Court in 2009, then for Illinois' same-sex civil union law passed last year.
Whether you file suit or whether you try and push legislation is determined by specific factors in a particular state, what your chances of success are.
One factor, she says, is the plaintiffs. The 25 couples in these cases run the demographic gamut. They're black, white, Hispanic, churchgoers, military veterans, college professors. They're from Chicago and downstate. Some have kids, some have no kids. One couple has chocolate Labrador retrievers. But Taylor said they've been chosen in part because they can deal with the pressures of litigation.
They will possibly have their lives exposed in newspapers. You know, sometimes people make comments underneath newspapers online that aren't very kind.
Comments online and through the mail. Janine Watkins shows me a white envelope addressed to her longtime partner, Lakeisha Harris. They're both plaintiffs in the Lambda case. And the envelope, stuffed with religious chapbooks, was postmarked the same day those suits were filed.
It's what to do to go to hell, spiritualism, sorcery, and witchcraft, AIDS, and you have a date. I guess with the Grim Reaper, because that's like one of the first pictures that you see.
Watkins and Harris, both from Chicago, say they have prepared themselves for this kind of stuff, and they've talked to their kids about what to expect as the suits move forward. Still, they say this piece of mail is a little scary. But they say they have a tight-knit family, the kind of people who can't seem to help but finish each other's sentences. And they say they're determined not to let the lawsuit take over their life.
She didn't stop doing the laundry yesterday.
Right. Didn't change anything.
It didn't change anything. Like, the kids are just like, okay, we filed a lawsuit. What's for dinner?
While Watkins and Harris wait out the litigation, the dozen or so lawyers working both cases are busy prepping for their first court hearings later this month. I'm Alex Keefe.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. This week, enjoy classic cover songs from the band PBS. More information about upcoming events is on KrannertCenter.com.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 12th of June, 2012. It's the birthday of Bridget Brophy, born London, 1929, wrote a book when she was just 24 called Hackenfeller's Ape, about a zoologist who becomes attached to the apes he's supposed to observe objectively. She wrote many more novels, The King of a Rainy Country, Palace Without Chairs, and then, even though sick in bed with MS, campaigned for the rights of women and animals and prisoners. Bridget Brophy, who said, "Whenever people say we mustn't be sentimental, you can take it they're about to do something cruel. And if they add we must be realistic, they mean they're going to make money out of it." It's the birthday of the woman who wrote Heidi. Johanna Spyri, born in Herzl, Switzerland, in 1827, wrote many stories and novels for children, but best known for Heidi. Heidi, a plucky young orphan who goes to live with her stern grandfather in the Alps, where she drinks goat milk and sleeps in a hayloft and becomes friends with the goat herd, Peter. It's the birthday of Anne Frank, born in Frankfurt, Germany, 1929. It was on this day in 1942, on her 13th birthday, she received a red and white plaid journal from her father, and she began keeping her diary. Here's a poem for today by Kristen Lindquist, How Baseball Saved My Marriage. One happy hour drink in Orono, and now I'm driving up the Penobscot just for kicks, past the bridge to Indian Island, past the just-closed Georgia Pacific plant, tidy yards of Milford, place of a million parts, junkyard, the drink still warm in my belly, the strong, true edge of things glowing with rich clarity in the late summer, late afternoon light. Dylan's tangled up in blue on the radio. Dozens of migrating nighthawks flit over fields along the river. Crickets shrill in tall grass. Window draft tickles my tan shoulders. Later tonight, the Red Sox will win with another big poppy walk-off homer that'll make me whoop to myself in the car. But for now, I'm moving through Olamon, Passadumkeg, away from the river, into the woods. It's the end of a long day, but there still seems to be plenty of time and road ahead. Something about the light, the beauty of the sky, makes me think I should keep going right on to northern Maine all the way to Canada. I could just keep driving all night, potato fields north of Holton, balancing the dark outside my car windows, lights across the St. John beckoning me over the border. I've got a full tank of gas, credit cards in my wallet. I could drive all the way to Nova Scotia or Prince Edward Island, stay in some quaint inn on a craggy coast, walk low beaches in search of sandpipers heading south from the Arctic. How far north do roads go? But it grows late, shadows deepen, and so far from home, I realize I don't know the station broadcasting tonight's game. So, it's finally baseball.